The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome back to The Commentary Track. I'm Frank Thompson, Frank Thompson, the All-American host, and we're here with part two of my interview with Randy Skredvet, Laurel and Hardy expert extraordinaire, also expert on many, many other things, including music of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and all sorts of comedy teams and movies in general. I hope you listened to last week's episode. This time we start off talking a little bit about Laurel and Hardy and segue, as we are wont to do, into other subjects. And it's great fun for me. As a matter of fact, I've got to say, I've gotten more good feedback from last week's episode with my talk with Randy than from any other single episode we've aired so far. And I think that's just a tribute to the power of Randy's engaging personality and his incredible knowledge of all things movies. So we've had a great time talking, and because I am at CineCon this weekend and up to my neck in great movies and special experiences and seeing old friends I haven't seen for a year, I am going to keep this short and sweet, as Henry Fonda's Abe Lincoln says, like the old woman's dance. So enjoy part two of the interview with Randy Skredvet, and we'll see you on the other side.
I'd been nuts about Laurel and Hardy for about a year, and I already had one of the little Larry Harmon Stan Laurel toys. It's a little plastic bank, and I still have it. And I was getting ready for school one morning, and I was going on and on, prattling on about Laurel and Hardy, and I said, gee, I wonder if either Laurel or Hardy is still alive. And right at that moment, my dad brought in the Los Angeles Times, and on the front page it said, Stan Laurel, 74, film comedian, dies at home. I had just finished saying, I wonder if either Laurel and Hardy are still alive. And boom, that was spooky. That was really spooky. And I think maybe that was what that experience is one reason why I was so eager to talk with people who had been working on those films, because I just missed Stan Laurel, you know. Oliver Hardy, of course, passed away a year before I was born, but I could have talked to Stan Laurel, you know. I would have been 6 years old, but I might have been able to ask an intelligent question or two at that point, because I was familiar with some of the films, you know. When I was 11, I had known about Sons of the Desert, and then I got an address for the Way Out West tent. And I wrote them, you know, asking about it. And Lori Jones, who is still Mama Hen of the Way Out West tent, and she's now Lori Jones McCaffrey, but she, I think she bent the rules. I think you were supposed to be 16 in order to be able to join, but I was 12. But she let me in, and thank goodness she did, because my first meeting was August of 1971. And Marvin Hatley, who was the musical director and who wrote the Cuckoo Song, he was there playing the piano. And Joe Rock, who had produced some of Stan Laurel's solo comedies, was there. And I think maybe Babe London, who's in Our Wife. Mm-hmm. You know, people like this were just routinely coming to the meetings because they lived in that area, you know, and they loved seeing these old films and schmoozing with their old buddies from the film industry, you know. And so I would get a little frustrated because they really did not do interviews with these people. You know, they would say, and we have with us, you know, today there's Joe Rock and there's Ruth Laurel, Stan's second wife, you know, take a bow, Ruth. And they'd introduce people, but then we'd watch Hogwild for the 40th time, you know. And I kind of thought, how come they're not, you know, asking these people about their connection with Laurel and Hardy? They're right here, you know, and they're the people who could tell the story. So by, I think, 1972, when I was 13, I was bringing a tape recorder to these meetings and trying to do little impromptu interviews before the meeting would start. And then, you know, as soon as they started doing banquets, I would tape whatever their speech would be at the banquet. Sometimes those could be pretty good. There was one time when Roy Seawright, who was the special effects director at Roach's, he was there for his first meeting at the banquet in 74 or 75, and he must have talked for 45 minutes, and it was a great recitation about how wonderful the Hal Roach Studio was, and he really gave us a lot of insight, and I used that a lot in my book. So any opportunity I had to capture these people, and their reminiscences about working there, I caught it. And by the time I got my driver's license, I was zooming all around the San Fernando Valley and Encino and Studio City and all those places, trying to get everybody I could while they were still around. So, nobody else seemed to be doing it, really. So I'm glad I did this when I did, because, we found Venice Lloyd, who was Art Lloyd's widow, and she still had all of her scrapbooks, and she used to come to the studio every day, even though she didn't work there. She would come and visit Artie and have lunch with him, and she knew everybody who worked there, and she had a great memory, and she had lots of interesting stories that nobody else was going to tell me. So, so I'm very glad that I got to meet all these people. I'm really blessed that I got interested in these old movies at such a young age, because, it wasn't that many years before they were all gone,
Sure.
And I still have all the audio tapes. And in fact, when I do finally finish the updated version of my Laurel and Hardy book, I'm planning on having with it a CD that will have a couple of minutes of each of the main people, 20 or 25 of the main people, so that you can get an idea of what they sounded like. Because when I read the quotes in the book, I hear those voices in my mind's ear, because I remember them saying these things to me. But most people don't know what they sounded like. And they all had great voices, too, even though most of them weren't actors. They all had very distinctive voices, so I want people to hear those people, and I've got the tapes. So, Jack McCabe never recorded anything. He always just took notes. And I always thought, what a loss, that we don't have interview tapes that he did with Stan Laurel, that he just took notes with Stan, Because for one thing, I think you're more accurate if you have it on tape. You can go back and find out exactly what they said.
Sure.
Instead of just what you think you remember they said.
And the manner in which they said it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I also found that there would be times where, like Hal Roach, for example, was a great one for halfway finishing a story, then getting off to five other things, and then coming back around and finishing up the story, And so it was great to have that all on tape to be able to piece it together accurately and maybe make it sound a little more coherent than it really did when he was telling it to you. Sometimes you have to do that, too. So anyway, I'm glad I still have all of that stuff. And
So it sounds to me like that you started writing about it more because you already had all this material and already had the interest. Whereas when I started writing about film, I decided to write about it first and then went about getting the interviews and so forth. You seem to have done it the other way.
The first piece I had published was in a magazine called Private Screenings, which was published by my friend John Cawley. And I think it was 1974. And it was an article about Laurel and Hardy. But this was a magazine that was geared to primarily Super 8 film collectors, because in those pre-home video days, that's what we had. So it would be a thing that would review all the releases from Black Hawk and Castle Films and Ken Films and whatever companies were out there, Thunderbird, Niles. There were all these companies that were bringing out public domain things and sometimes licensed movies as well. So that's the first thing that I ever wrote for publication, and I was in, I think, my first year of high school when that came out. But when I talked to these Laurel and Hardy people, they would tell me these wonderful stories that really made me feel as though I were right there at the studio. You could really get a sense of what it was like working on those films day after day. And none of this was captured in any of the available books. I mean, Mr. Laurel and Mr. Hardy by John McCabe has some nice quotes from Stan about his observations on comedy and that sort of thing, but you don't really get a sense of what the working day was like at Hal Roach Studios. And so I put together a chapter outline and a sample chapter, which was on Babes in Toyland, because it just so happened that I'd gotten really great interviews with not only Mr. Roach, but Henry Brandon, Felix Knight, and a couple of other key people for that particular film, and they all had really good juicy stories. So I thought, well, that's a good one to write about first, because I've got more information on that one. And you know, I sent this out and I got rejections from all sorts of publishers, and they all said, well, there's the John McKay book, there's the William K. Everson films of Laurel and Hardy, and there's Richard Nobley's little picture book with the quotes of the dialogue, and there's that coffee table book by Kilgore and Bann and McCabe. So we think they've really been covered. And I thought, no, because I have all these stories that I know aren't printed anywhere. So finally it came out with Jordan Young's publishing company, Moonstone Press. He'd already published two or three books on various aspects of old entertainment, and this was, you know, perfectly fitting with what he'd published before. So that's how it came out, which is great because I made a lot more money on it that way. And, you know, I spent, what, from 1979 through late 1986 researching and writing the book every day. It was a long process. As you know, if you're doing a historical book like this and you have to do a lot of excavation and digging and trying to find long lost records and try to track down people and do interviews, it's a very lengthy process. So that's why it took so long. And then after the book came out, I think we did two and a half, three years of just promoting it and selling it and doing interviews with radio people and, you know, plugging it any way we could. And eventually we sold 25,000 copies. So that wasn't too bad for a book of that nature. You know, it's not going to topple Stephen King or any of those guys, but, you know, for what it is and for being a niche market type of book, we did pretty well. So
that's really impressive. Yeah. I don't think any of my books have ever sold. I published 40 books probably all together. They've never sold 25,000 copies.
Oh, well, you know, we did a book on Steve Martin, and I think that sold 18,000 or something. So, but it's just, you know.
I like to write books that nobody will ever read. That's kind of my niche.
Well, you see, now we have this wonderful publishing on demand. So you can write books about incredibly, you know, niche items, you know, that, you know, major publishers 20 years ago would never touch. But now you can. I mean, that's why Bear Manor Media has most of the titles. They come out with a lot of titles practically every month. And I think the only reason they can do it is because they just print them up as they get orders. You know, if you had to do it like an old-fashioned publisher where you print 3,000 or 5,000 copies and then you've got them in a warehouse and you're hoping to sell them, you know, that's a lot of overhead right there. So, and that's the way we did the Laurel and Hardy book way back in 1987 when it first came out. So, you know, I still have hardcovers from 1988 somewhere.
Really? Well, I have my hardcover that I got the year that it came out.
Well, it came out in England from another company, and we did two updates in a paperback format. So the last version came out in 1996. So it's high time for a new version because there's just so much more information on, you know, both the supporting players and the technical crew. So I hope it won't be too much longer, but it will probably be another 100 pages. And it was, what was it, 400 and it was almost 500 pages in the last edition.
Wow.
Well,
I want to read it.
Yeah, well, eventually I hope to say, okay, this is it. You know, I want to go and write about something else now. I do also eventually, in addition to the radio book, I want to write a book about 1920s dance bands because that is, ironically, for the music that is the soundtrack of what they always call the jazz age, it's never written about by jazz scholars.
Sure.
It's totally ignored. They talk about the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and they'll talk about King Oliver and the Louis Armstrong Hot Fives and Jelly Roll Morton, and then they jump to 1935 and Benny Goodman and the Swing Era.
Yeah.
And they never talk about the Coon Sanders Nighthawks or the Ipana Troubadours or Irving Aronson's Commanders or any of these 20s dance bands, Ted Weems, Waring's Pennsylvanians, you know, George Olson and his music. They're just the only time they're ever referred to in any of the reference books is if one of the musicians later became a big band leader. So, for example, they'll say, well, Artie Shaw was a member of Irving Aronson's Commanders and the Roger Wolfcon Orchestra in the late 20s. But that's it. You know, it's only because of his later fame that they mention these earlier bands.
Sure.
And I mean, to me, this is a whole style of music that, you know, it's wonderful stuff. I mean, I got interested in it because it's the type of music that you hear in the Laurel and Hardy, the early shorts of the early 30s, that bouncy, wonderful Leroy Shield and Marvin Hatley music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to hear I wanted to hear those tunes without the dialogue on them, which thank God we can now with the Bohunks recreations.
Yeah.
And by the way, I remember talking to Roy Seawright, and he said, well, you know, I'm probably the guy who threw away that wonderful music that you want, because he said when the government took over the Hal Roach Studios in 1942 to make training films, I was given a direct order to throw away as much stuff as I possibly could to make space for them to come in and make these training films. And so he said, I remember having to take scripts and stills and any trims and outs and, you know, any old film that we still had stored that we weren't going to be reprinting. And I had to pitch it into the incinerator. And he said it was probably all that music track stuff, because that was on 35 optical.
Yeah.
And I remember also Richard Currier said we had a certain can of the optical soundtrack for the Cuckoo Song. And he said, and we kept using that same one over and over again. It kept getting shorter and shorter and shorter because we kept splicing it onto the to make a negative, you know. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually did get to reclaim what still existed of the original music tracks, because Marvin Hadley became a particularly dear friend of mine. As I say, I first met him, I think, at my first Sons of the Desert meeting in August of 1971, which is when I was 12. I just missed meeting Billy Gilbert, by the way, because the previous meeting that they had had in Los Angeles was their first banquet in June of 1971, and Billy Gilbert had been the special guest, and he died in September of 71. So missed it by that much, unfortunately. But Marvin Hadley was there and still playing fantastic piano. He was a great stride style piano player. And stride style is kind of like Fats Waller.
Sure.
Or James P. Johnson, if you know who that is. It's a very, very active left hand. And he would not only play the piano, he had a little drum kit that he had underneath the piano, which had a snare drum and a wire brush and also a little cymbal. So he could do a pretty good rhythm section with the piano. And he also had a bass trumpet, which is sort of pitched between a trombone and a normal trumpet. And he would play that with his right hand as he played the stride-style left hand. So he was a very good one-man band. And whenever you came to his house, his wife, Josephine, who was a real firecracker, she would meet you at the door and she'd say, well, it sounds like Marvin is having a jam session with some of his friends. Let's go in and visit them, shall we? And then she'd take you into this music room, and here was this one little man hunched over the piano playing the trumpet with the right hand and playing the drums with his feet. So that was always her little joke at the beginning for any new people that would come in the first time. But Marvin for years was saying, well, he was trying to get a new recording of some of the scores that he'd written for Blockheads and things like that. And at one point got as far as RCA Victory even having album artwork made for it.
Hmm.
And for some reason that fell through, but it was going to happen because he showed me the artwork. But he kept saying, well, I have some old scratchy records, but nobody'd be interested in those. And I kept saying, yes, we would. That's precisely what we want to hear, are those old scratchy records. And he finally brought them down, and they were glass-based transcriptions, which I'm glad they weren't broken, because those are very fragile. They made those during World War II. Usually acetates are made with an aluminum base. But when there was a metal shortage and there were metal drives during World War II, they began making them on glass base. So those are very, very breakable. And he had a fair amount of music from Way Out West and Sons of the Desert. And he had a few things from Saps at Sea and A Chump at Oxford. And even some things from Them Thar Hills, which is one of the shorts for which he almost entirely wrote the score. I know Leroy Scheel gets all the credit now for all the short subjects, but he didn't write everything. And Marvin Hadley also made the arrangements, hired the musicians, and did the recordings for those Leroy Scheel tracks. Hmm. So Leroy Scheel was great, but what Leroy Scheel wrote out was a lead sheet of just the melody of whatever that particular tune is. And I know because Marvin still had some of them, and I have Xeroxes of them. So a lot of that wonderful signature sound that we have in those early 30s shorts still comes from Marvin Hadley, even though he may not have composed those tunes. He also wrote a lot of the songs songs, almost all of the songs, in the Charlie Chase pictures. He and Charlie would collaborate. And so those are almost all Hatley melodies. So he was still a busy guy, even if he wasn't writing every piece of music in the Hal Roach Studios. But he brought out these wonderful records. And I think he also still had some 35 millimeter nitrate optical soundtrack. And I took all of that, and I found a guy in Spurdvac, in the old radio group, who was particularly good at cleaning and doing sound restoration on these acetate recordings. So he did that for me on those, and then I found a guy named Bill Lindholm, who had worked at Black Hawk Films at one point, mm-hmm. and was well-versed in Laurel and Hardy, and he helped me get the nitrate transferred to less flammable recording tape. And so eventually I put out an album in 1982, and the first side of it was all these wonderful old original tracks, which have complete versions of Honolulu Baby from Sons of the Desert without the dialogue that's in the final soundtrack version. And there's an extended version of Will You Be My Lovey-Dovey from Way Out West by Sharon Lynn. And since Marvin was still a great musician, I was going to college at the time at Cal State Fullerton, and I had a friend in a TV writing class named Scott Comerford, whose dad had written for radio comedy. He'd written the Jack Kirkwood Show in the 40s. Anyway, Scott had a multi-track reel-to-reel tape recorder. So, shades of Les Paul and Mary Ford, we said, well, we can do Marvin playing the piano and the trumpet and the tuba and the accordion and the celeste and all these other things that he plays. And so we figured out how to record this and what piece should go where. And so we got Marvin, you know, quadruple tracked playing everything. And we made, I think, 6 new tracks. They're mainly songs that he'd written in the early 30s. But that's, you know, pretty much all that exists of him, you know, in complete performances, although I do have lots of tapes that I just recorded, you know, on the fly at Sons of the Desert meetings. I would always bring a tape recorder and set it up by his piano because he was just so great to listen to. So anyway,
I'll bet you were there the only time I ever went to one of those, which was in 79, because he was playing that night.
Mm-hmm.
And the feature was Bonnie Scotland. And who was the male lead in Bonnie Scotland?
William Janney?
He was there, yes.
William Janney and probably June Lang, too.
Yeah.
She might have been there because they were the young lovers.
Yeah, and I was very impressed to meet T. Marvin Hatley because I didn't expect him to even be alive. So there
yeah.
he was.
Yeah, he was playing, I think, right up until about 1985. So, you know, he was a fixture at all those meetings and very happy to do it. You know, he would even come out to Orange County. He did some banquets for us down here.
Hmm.
So, and Anita Garvin came out one time. She lived in, Camarillo, and she drove all the way out in her little Honda Civic. And in those days they were little Honda Civics, and she drove all the way out to Buena Park, and we put her up at the Buena Park Hotel, and she was very happy to meet the gang down south, down here. So
now, for people like Anita Garvin, did you interview her on several occasions?
Well, I mean, the great thing was I didn't just interview them, I became friends with them, you know. Anita kind of got into the whole Sons of the Desert thing because Bob Satterfield, who was the grand sheik of the Way Out West tent, the Los Angeles group, invited her to one of their functions. And the key phrase was, he said, "And if there is a Mr. Stanley, he is welcome also." And Anita was so impressed by that it wasn't just she being invited, that she said okay, and she became involved with the group. She probably had heard of the Sons of the Desert before, but just hadn't gotten involved with it. But of course, we were so delighted to have one of the key supporting players still around, because, you know, Finlayson and May Bush and Charlie Hall were all long gone, you know. And here was Anita Garvin, who really had always been my favorite of all the supporting players. I always thought she was the most creative actress. Sure. and the most subtle, and the one who really, aside from Hardy, I think she understood the camera better than anybody working in movies at that time. You know, how you scale a performance for the camera. And I asked her about that, and she said, well, nobody ever told me about it. She says, I just figured that when you're in a long shot, you play it fairly broadly. When you're in a medium shot, you play it less broadly. And when you're in a close-up, you hardly have to do anything. And I said, yes, but so few people then or now understand that, you know. And so anyway, yes, she lived in Camarillo, and her husband, Red Stanley, was still around at that time. And to my lasting regret, I never did an interview with Red, because He was a member of Irving Aronson's Commanders, and he was one of the two key people. In fact, there he is right there. He was the trombonist and eccentric dancer and main comedian in the band.
Wow.
This was very much a variety show type band, a stage band. And so he was one of the key players, and I sure wish I had interviewed him, but he was very quiet and deferential, and he just said, well, you guys want to talk to Anita, so I'll just go in my room and read, you know. And he died in, I think, March of 1980, and of course Anita lived on till 1994, I think. So I had many years where I got to see Anita and, you know, would try and get up to see her every couple of months or so. She lived in Camarillo at first, and then she had an apartment for a while, and then she was at the motion picture home, and I got to see her several times there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though she gradually was getting a little more and more infirm because of age, her wit never left her. I remember one time we were having lunch at the motion picture home, and somebody dropped some dishes, and Anita was in the middle of telling us something, and without so much as a blink, she said, "Wait for your laugh, honey." And I thought, now who else except an old former slapstick movie comedian would say, "Wait for your laugh, honey," after somebody drops a tray of dishes, you know? So she was just wonderful to know. And I've been talking about all these great interviews I have on cassette tape, which I have to get transferred. I've got Super 8 sound film, about 25 minutes each, of Anita Garvin, Joe Rock, and Roy Seawright.
Wow.
And, you know, they talk about their career, primarily Laurel and Hardy, obviously. But so I was smart enough to get that. I didn't have a video camera in those days, because this is probably 1975 or 6 when I shot this. So I was 16 or 17 years old, you know. But I did have the presence of mind to try and get them on Super 8 sound film. I also have a wonderful Super 8 sound film of Curly Joe DeRita.
Gee.
The one day I met him, which was a wonderful day. He was a very intelligent man and very highly opinionated about a large number of topics. And I have him on Super 8 sound film, and he does this. He says, "I don't think the Three Stooges were funny. I don't think the Three Stooges were funny." And he says, To be a comedian, you had to have a certain comedic point of view, a humor. And neither Moe nor Larry had any individual sense of humor. He said they were physical. What made them good is that they were physical. But I would come in with new gag ideas or things that I had done in Minsky's that would fit them. And if they hadn't done it for 25 years already, they would burn it into the ground. And I keep threatening to come to a Three Stooges convention and show that, because, you know, that would be an eye-opener.
It really would be.
So, yeah, I actually did get to quote it. I have that, and I have reel-to-reel tape of Larry. Larry Fine, who was very, very good friends with Jeff and Greg Lenberg, he came to their high school, Loera High School in Anaheim, to do a benefit show for the drama department of the high school. And you know, he'd had the stroke, but he still, his memory was fine, and he was speaking very intelligibly. You know, he was impaired to some degree, but he was still a really funny guy and had a good memory. And I seem to be the only person who brought a tape recorder. There, wow. There must have been 300 or 400 people in that auditorium, but I'm evidently the only one who brought a tape recorder. And I still got the tape, and the recorder still works fine, so I was able to use that in a book called Stooges Among Us, which was put together by my friend Lon and Deborah Davis, put it together. And it's a book of reminiscences from people my age. We were all teenagers in the early 70s when, you know, Moe and Larry and Curly Joe and Joe Besser were all still around, and we all made the effort to come out and see them. And fortunately, they were all very amenable to that. So, you know, it's a really interesting book, because it's all these former 70s teenagers talking about their, you know, their buddies, Moe and Larry and Joe and Curly Joe. I also got to interview Emil Sitka, who's one of the key supporting players.
I knew Emil pretty well.
Did you?
Yeah.
The Lenbergs and I went out to his place in Camarillo, and I think he talked for 5 hours, because I think I've got five, it might even be more, I think may even be 5 C90 cassette tapes, because he loved to talk, and he was very interesting, so we let him.
Oh, yeah. He was a good letter writer, too. I have a big stack of letters from him.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Oh, I want to see those. Yeah. His son, you know, has an Emil Sitka fan club online.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a really interesting story. I think Emil was a single parent and was raising quite a few kids all by himself as a working actor. So
he was, for people who don't really remember him, he was a foil for the Stooges in several of the later shorts, mostly the late 40s and 50s. And
Old Hands, You Love Birds. Yes. Brideless Groom. He's the Justice of the Peace.
Yes. And he even became a Stooge very briefly when they were trying to figure out how to. There were several third Stooges who came and went. And we know Curly Joe DeRita and Joe Besser and
Shemp.
Yeah, Shemp, of course. But they tried him out. There are stills that exist. I think that's really all that. Documents, that brief period.
I forget what the film was, but they were trying to do this film. It was about 1971 or two or something. Mm-hmm. Larry had already had the stroke, which is why Emil was drafted to be the new third Stooge. So it would have been Moe and Emil and Curly Joe.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are quite a few stills that they shot that day. But Emil is the only guy to have worked with all four sets of Stooges, because his first film with them was Curly's last.
Mm.
So he got in at the very last moment. It was Half-Wit's Holiday was Curly's last film. And Emil's the butler in that. So,
yeah.
But he's very prominent in the Shemp and Joe and Curly Joe films. And in fact, he's even in a lot of those color cartoon wraparounds that they did.
Mm-hmm.
They did live action beginnings and endings with the cartoon in the middle. And Emil is in a lot of those as well. So he certainly is the dominant supporting player of the Three Stooges from 1947 onward.
Now, did you meet Mo and
I never met Mo. Never got to meet Mo, but I did meet Larry that just the one day, but then did get to talk with him backstage, and he autographed my copy of Stroke of Luck, which is his book.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a year after that, there was a Three Stooges banquet put on by a guy named Doug Wright, who used to run a thing out here in Anaheim called the Old Movie Theater and Motion Picture Hall of Fame. And it was basically two motel rooms with a wall knocked out in the Saga Motel, which was on Harbor Boulevard right across from Disneyland. And the first section of the building was this museum where he had a bunch of old movie props and things. And then there was a theater where he would run 16 millimeter prints, primarily comedies. And it's where I and a whole bunch of people that I know who lived in this neighborhood, we wasted a lot of our youth, but we sure got a good film education out of that little place. And he would occasionally do special events, and he did a Stooge evening, and Shemp's widow was there, Moe's widow was there, Larry's daughter and her husband Don LeMond, who was a fixture on local television out here, Ed Burns, who was a director of theirs, was there, Bus Libet, who was the sound effects guy. You know, all these people were there, and I got them all to sign my copy of Stroke of Luck. So,
nice.
So one of these days when I, you know, need to retire, I can sell that to some rabid Stooge fan, because it has all the, it also later on I got Joe and Ernie Besser to sign it, and also Curly Joe DeRita. So
wow. It
has just about everybody who was still around at the time, you know. So yeah, and I never did get to meet Mo, but I met Larry the one time. I met Joe DeRita the one time, and we spent. It was at a sort of a film memorabilia convention, and we didn't even really know if he was going to be there or not, but he was, and we spent about 4 hours talking with him. So he was a really fun, interesting guy, and
we,
you know, the day just flew by, and we talked about all manner of things, not always Stooge-related. My parents were both born and raised in rural northern Minnesota in a little town called Gary, which I think at its height had 300 people. And in 1951, they've been married for about 3 years, and they just decided that they were going to come out to Southern California and make a new life out here. I think they were just tired of the winters up there.
I can see how they would be.
And so I'm very glad they did, and I want to thank them for doing that, because the only reason that I'm here talking to you about having met and interviewed all these great people is because I was fortunate enough to live in Southern California, and these people weren't exactly in my backyard, but they were 25 or 30 miles up the 5 and 101 freeway, you know, so
yeah, I envy close enough. You that. I was brought up, as I said before, in South Carolina.
Yeah.
And there were no celebrities in South Carolina except Strom Thurmond, who had relatively little to say about William Wellman, you know. So it never even occurred to me that you could even meet these people, much less interview them. Or I mean, it didn't even occur to me that they were actual people in some way.
I was already talking to a lot of people who had worked in the film industry in the 20s and 30s when I was in high school. And so when I got into college and I was a film major at Cal State Fullerton, sometimes having talked to these people and getting a real sense for what it was like working in the studios day after day, I would really shake my head at some of the pronouncements made by film professors, you know, because they read in a lot of crazy things into films that are not there. I remember I had one professor, and I forget what the film is, but it was something from the late 30s. And there was a scene where this woman just walks from one room into another room, and there's a white door, and it has the pattern of the door has a sort of a cross figure at the beginning and two little squares at the bottom. And he says, "Now, see the significance of this door? This door is what they call a cross and Bible door. And the significance of the pattern of that door is that she's making a transition from her old life into her new life by going through that door." And I sat there and I listened to him and I said, "I guarantee you the director of this film had no such intent, and the only reason that door is there is because that's what was in the art direction department, and that's what worked with that wall unit. You know, yeah. I guarantee you."
Absolutely. Oh, I remember reading an article one time in Film Comment, which was generally a much more trustworthy magazine than this, but a guy was writing about George Sidney.
Uh-huh.
And he's writing about the credit sequence of the Harvey Girls and how in the credit sequence – there's a train in a frame, in a picture frame, a picture of a train in a picture frame, which is used metaphorically by Sidney to establish that we are looking into the past. And I thought, if this guy thinks that George Sidney had anything to do with the credit sequence of anything he ever did, he is drastically mistaken.
The first time he knew about that credit sequence was when he was watching the premiere of the movie.
Exactly.
Honest, yeah. Oh, yeah, what's I forget now the name of the picture. I wish I could remember it now. But there's one film. It's from sometime in the 50s, and this was during the time when everybody wanted to get a hit record from the theme song of whatever the picture is. And was it Jules Dassin? I don't know who the director is. Anyway, you know, he goes to the premiere of this movie, and unbeknownst to him, the producer has created this, has gotten somebody to write this, you know, hit theme song, or they hope will be a hit theme song from this movie. And it was just totally out of tone with what the director was trying to establish in the actual body of the film, you know. So he said, "Well, that's just one of those things that you can't control, you know, the producer is the guy who has the money, and he wants a hit record. Well, you know, he's going to put that on the title sequence." I mean, it really is true that movies of the 20s and 30s and 40s are auteur films, but the auteur is not the director. The auteur is the producer.
Yeah.
That's the guy who really oversaw the film.
Sure.
And, I mean, yes, certainly there were creative directors, obviously. Wellman had a style. Hitchcock had a style. Cukor had a style. But I think there are also producers who had a style.
Absolutely.
And then there are people who were both, like Mervyn LeRoy. Mervyn LeRoy is really the guy who was the chief cook and bottle washer on The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
He was the one who kept begging Louis B. Mayer to buy that property. RKO had bought it. They wanted to make an Eddie Cantor movie out of it. And they bought it around 1932 or 33, because I remember seeing an article in the Hollywood Reporter about that when they bought the property from the Baum estate. But, you know, he was really the guy who oversaw that production. I think he's the one who fired Richard Thorpe because he didn't like the way the footage was coming out. And he brought in Cukor to, you know, tell me what's wrong with this. And Cukor is the one who said, "Well, you've got Judy Garland with this blonde wig and all this makeup, and she looks like a storybook character just like everybody else. And she can't do that because she's supposed to be a little girl from Kansas, and she's the audience's representative. So make her look plain and ordinary." Oh, okay. You know, and then they brought in Fleming, and then later on they brought in King Vidor, you know, so it's, there's a case of a creative producer overseeing it, but you rarely hear his name connected with The Wizard of Oz.
No.
They always think it's Freed who was actually learning the ropes of being a producer on that picture.
And there was also a certain studio style that they had to contend with.
Yes, there's Mayer to contend with too,
Yeah, when you look at, you know, I started looking at all the Wellman films when I was first working on that book in the late 70s. and all the early 30s Warner Brothers stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was still young and didn't really understand a lot of what I was seeing,
mm-hmm.
I was attributing a lot to Wellman that was not Wellman. And
it's the house style.
It was the house style. Mm-hmm. And so you do look at early 30s things that were being made by Lloyd Bacon or Mervyn LeRoy or any number of...
Ray Enright.
Yeah. And and you'll see a lot of the same kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and you do start to notice very specific things that you think, okay, that is Wellman. There, mm-hmm. There's Wellman right there.
Right.
But a lot of the just the framing and a lot of the things that you tend to think of as director style is not necessarily
director style. How much of this is Wellman and how much of it is Daryl Zanuck or Jack Warner or Hal Wallace or whoever the producer happened to be, you know? There's a lot of people overseeing any movie because there's a lot of money involved, you know?
That's why this auteur theory is valuable in a way, but the more you study film and the way films are actually made, the less that stuff makes much sense because you just start seeing what has to happen.
Yeah. And I mean, really, the only auteur that you can say definitely is Chaplin.
Yeah.
Because he owned the studio. He was paying the bills out of his own pocket. He wrote it, directed it, edited it, scored it, you know, cast it. So, okay, there you go. But that's really the only example where you can say that this is – you know, one man, one film, as Frank Capra was so fond of saying. You know, well, Frank, I love your movies, but, you know, there is Robert Riskin to be considered.
Oh, a big consideration, too.
As Fay Wray would tell you,
yes.
Mrs. Riskin.
Oh, yeah. I once wrote something in American Film Magazine about Magic Town, which Riskin wrote and Wellman directed, and which is not a very good film. Because Wellman is not Capra, and he's just not suited to it very well. But I said something that Fay Wray took wrong and got a letter from her.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately wrote back and said, well, I guess I was just clumsy when I wrote this, and here's what you know what I was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And we started a correspondence that lasted for 2 years. So there was so that in turn turned out very well.
Yeah.
But Riskin you know, to attribute all the stuff that we do to John Ford without, you know, thinking about Nunley Johnson and all the people who wrote those scripts.
Right.
And of which there are scenes very specifically laid out in the script in terms of where people are standing and what we are seeing. That is not Ford at all, but is the writer.
Yeah.
And we, even today, we still tend to think, this is John Ford's film, but it's a lot more complicated than that.
It takes nothing away from any of those people to say that they collaborated well.
Yeah.
You know, it's a combination of talents, and everybody contributes. I mean, even when I was talking with Burt Jordan about cutting Laurel and Hardy films, he would say, well, he said, I had the right of first cut. And, you know, you think, oh, you know, that's Burt Jordan. It's not Stan Laurel. It's not Hal Roach. It's not Leo McCarey. It's Burt Jordan who goes through all the footage and he figures out where the close-ups should go and where all these things. And he would say, then after I did the first cut, Stan would come in and look at it. And he'd say, well, I'll tell you, Burt, I think this plays better in the two shot than it does in the master shot. Or, you know, he might have some changes. And he said, sometimes there weren't many changes at all. So you think, okay, well, there's an example of, you know, the editor comes into the creative process, and that's a very important part of filmmaking. You know, sometimes you can kill a picture or you can make a picture with a good editor, you know.
Yeah.
I remember seeing the DVD of the footage of Marilyn Monroe's last movie, Something's Gotta Give, which she didn't finish. And when you see the 40 minutes of it that they were able to cut together, you go, well, she's giving a perfectly fine performance. She's just great. There's no problem.
Sure.
She's really good. Then they show you the unedited footage, and she can barely remember one line to the next, and she's clearly in trouble. And you go, wow, this is a performance created in the editing room. You know, and it really brings that home to you, how much an editor can make or break a picture. You know?
Oh, yeah. So. I mean, I think one of the prime examples of this is Citizen Kane, which
– Robert Wise.
One of the great – pictures of all time, of course, and I agree that it's probably in the top three or four best movies ever made.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people had their hands in that thing, and you know, you look at the photography and lots made of the, how the ceilings are there. Well, gosh, that's,
it's Greg Toland and Van Nest Polglaze and the art direction people. Of course, they may have been saying, you know, they may have gotten orders from Wells saying, well, I want ceilings to show. And they probably did. But, you know, they were the ones who actually realized it, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, Herman Mankiewicz and Robert Wise's editing and Greg Toland's cinematography and Bernard Herrmann's music, not to mention Everett Sloan and Dorothy Cummingore and all these great people in the cast who are giving, you know, their first and best ever film performance in that movie, you know.
I guess the best thing you can say about a film director as auteur is somebody who, despite all that, is able to bring some sort of consistent style from film to film that is recognizably his. And Hitchcock is an obvious example.
Right.
John Ford is one. But, you know, Wellman, you know, of course, he's deep in my heart, but he's not one. He does, there are elements of Wellman that show up, but there's not a real Wellman style. You can't look at Yellow Sky and say, ah, I know who directed that. If you didn't know, you wouldn't know. Whereas Hitchcock, much more so, I think. Yeah. And
I just tend to think of Wellman as always doing things with a lot of panache. You know, whatever the film called for, he didn't do things by halves, you know. And that's why he's the same director who made Public Enemy and Roxy Hart.
Yeah.
And those are two very different movies in tone and in storyline. But what they have in common is that they're rock'em sock'em pictures.
Yeah.
You know, and one is funny as all get out and one is dramatic as all get out, but there's nothing tepid about them.
Yeah. And I think, as we were saying earlier, that's one of the things that works against some directors like Michael Curtiz, who is a remarkable director.
Yeah.
And yet never established what you would call a Michael Curtiz style, except just an overall excellence at whatever he did. And there are virtually no bad Curtiz films.
Right. Yeah. There are filmmakers who say, what works for this picture or what works for this scene?
Yeah.
You know, and that's how they go about it. They did not have a set in stone visual style. Now, you know, Wells certainly learned from Greg Toland, but I can look at a Wells shot and go, this is an Orson Welles movie.
Yeah.
There's just something about, I don't know if it's the lens he uses or the filters he uses or what it is, but there's something where you just go, "That's I don't even know which picture this is from, but that's Orson Welles." Just the composition of it and the the overall unusual look of it.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the first time I saw Citizen Kane. I think I was 11 years old, and it was just running on a Sunday afternoon on TV on Channel 11. And I actually tuned into it a few minutes in. They were running the News on the March sequence, so I didn't get to see Rosebud at the beginning. But what caught my eye was the shot where they had Kane's zoo, and there are these two giraffes, and they happen to crane their necks up at the camera in perfect unison. And they go up, and they look, and then there's a cut. And I went, wow! Something hit me about that shot and the way it was cut. At my little 11-year-old brain just went, that was great! I don't know why! But something about the way that moved and the way they cut on it was great.
Yeah.
And I said, what is this? And then they had the phony shot of him with Teddy Roosevelt and all the scratches and spots on the film. And I said, I know this is a fake newsreel, but this actually looks like real old footage, unlike most fake newsreels. You know, whenever they usually try to do old footage, it looks too clean. You know, and of course, I later learned from Robert Wise that they actually took sandbags and they put the film, they round the film through moviolas with sandbags on it to scratch it all up. You know, and I think they shot with old Mitchell cameras from the silent days. You know, they really did everything authentically. So I was really captivated by that film, and just the look of it was what caught me when I was 11. I said, I've never seen a film that looks like this with the deep focus and so many shadows and ceilings and shots from underneath the floor looking all the way up and all these interesting things. So I was really captivated by that film, and I like Wells very much. I don't think he made very many good movies, but they're all interesting movies.
Yeah. I enjoy watching all of them, even if at the end I say, not very good.
Yeah.
But he's the exact opposite in some way of, say, George Marshall, who also almost never made a movie that wasn't pretty good. And some that are really good.
He was a nice guy. I got to meet him.
Worked with Laurel and Hardy.
Only met him once at his Sons of the, in 1972 at a Sons of the Desert banquet. And I had my little tape recorder. So I do have reel-to-reel tape on him. And I said, hello. I'm 14 years old. And I said, hello, Mr. Marshall. My name is Randy Skretved. And I'd love to be able to talk with you about working with Laurel and Hardy. And he put his arm around my shoulder and said, hello there, Randy. Let's go to the bar. This is at the L.A. Press Club building. So we're sitting there at the bar, and then he introduces me to his wife, Frenchie, whom I think he met during the Great War, because she sounded like Fifi Dorsey. She was this great – she looked kind of like Babe London. She was this great Zaftig woman with a lot of white hair piled up high and, you know, oh, hello, Randy. I'm very glad to meet you. And, you know, I still have a cocktail napkin where he wrote out his business address for me, you know, 1040 North Formosa Avenue, North Hollywood, California. And so, yeah, I have some tape of him talking about, you know, working with Laurel and Hardy and whatever the quote is where he's talking about how – he said, usually the director is supposed to educate the actors. And he said, in my case of Laurel and Hardy, I found I was learning so much more about filmmaking from Stan Laurel rather than he learning anything from me. You know, that's all from that night at the Sons banquet.
Nice. So,
but yeah, you're right. He is another great generalist, you know, because, Destry Rides Again, that's a movie that has a lot of shifts in tone. You know, part of it's comedy, part of it's pretty stark. Mm-hmm. And he handles it all very deftly, and he keeps it moving. And The Blue Dahlia is a great picture.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, truth to tell, I'm rather fond of Boy, Did I Get a Wrong Number, which I know is not a great movie, it has some moments. It has some nice moments.
And Houdini,
It
has such a dark, morbid feel to it.
It's just I saw that a couple of years ago when Tony Curtis was there to introduce it. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, he's another one where he was too good at too many kinds of movies to really warrant a following because you can't pigeonhole him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Hitchcock, it's not as if he made the same picture over and over and over again, but he made the same kind of picture.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why he's the master of suspense. And he's very easy to talk about, and there's 120 books on Hitchcock because he's easy. But what do you say about Michael Curtiz? Do you just do the Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland westerns, or do you just do a book on Casablanca and Bogart movies, or do you do Doris Day films, or, you know, what do you do? There's so many different kinds.
So, yeah, there's no handle to get
on. Yeah, it represents a challenge for somebody trying to write about him because if you insist on finding themes or a worldview or a stylistic consistency in his films, you're not going to find it outside of the fact that they're all good. You know, that's all there is. They're just all good movies. You know, they look as different from each other as they possibly can. Casablanca and Romance on the High Seas don't look like the same man made them, but, you know, there you are.
A lot of these other guys had Wellman, Walsh, Hawks. They were all such vivid personalities that in some ways, and I know that I'm guilty of this myself, some ways we approach their films through their, through what we know about them. And
I think there's a validity to that, though.
Yeah, I think there is, too. But that's not the case with Curtiz, who we don't have those kind of ideas about.
Outside of the fact that he mangled the language like Samuel Goldwyn.
The malaprops, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, bring on the empty horses.
Right,
It's really interesting because I started out writing about film – well, after you did, I guess, even though I'm older than you are, I think I started
in the later. Early 70s, so I was, like I say, I was, I think, in my first year of high school. So.
Yeah, my first, I decided to start writing the Wellman book in 1979, and that was the first thing I ever wrote. Never wrote an article, never wrote anything. And so, you know, I it's interesting to me how my ideas have evolved since then, because I think about when I first started writing, what I knew and what I didn't know.
Right.
And my Wellman book, I think, still holds up. I mean, I'm not ashamed of it by any means. I think it's all pretty valid. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't write that same book by any means now.
That's why I'm very grateful to have another crack at the Laurel and Hardy book because, you know, I finished that in 1986, and I've been watching lots and lots and lots of other movies since 1986, and so my understanding of the entire world of movies of that era is much greater now than it was when I wrote that, and so I can apply that to Laurel and Hardy, You know, I now know some of the other credits that a lot of their coworkers had, which are interesting and which do pertain in some way. And I'm more aware of what other comedians were making at the time and how film comedy in general was changing over those years.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I had a real good handle on that at those times when I was writing the book originally, because I pretty much saw Laurel and Hardy in a vacuum. You know, they were what they were. And, you know, I didn't really have access to a lot of the other Hal Roach material. You know, where did you see Charlie Chase films in those days? You know, you really, it was quite hard to see, you know, the Zazu Pitts and Thelma Todd films, mm-hmm. or the Taxi Boys,
yeah.
or any of those things. I mean, I read about them because of Leonard Maltin's book about short subjects, so I knew they existed. And I had an idea of what people at the Roach Studios were working on. But in terms of actually seeing the films, you know, I didn't have much experience with that. And now that I have seen them, it makes me appreciate Stan Laurel all the more, because I think the Laurel and Hardy films make more sense. They have strong – ironically, you know, Hal Roach's criticism was always that Stan Laurel wasn't very good in story. Well, I hate to tell you this, but I think the Laurel and Hardy films generally have stronger, more coherent storylines than any of the Roach films.
I agree.
I mean, I love Charlie Chase, but a lot of his films tend to be five scenes in search of a plot line.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like you look at The Cracked Iceman and you go, well, that was a fun 20 minutes, but what the hell was that all about? I have no – if I had to tell you what that story was about, I could not tell you. You know, there's one scene where he's trying to capture a bird. There's one scene where he's a school teacher. There's one scene where it's this. But what does it add up to? I don't know. You know, so I find that the Laurel and Hardy films are far and away more intelligently plotted. The Our Gang films next, and then after that, the rest of the Roach films are kind of working on a lower level.
Yeah, you have to take all the rest one by one.
Yeah.
And some of them are okay, and some of them are not.
Yeah.
But I would contend that Hal Roach is another one of the producers whose style overrides at least the directors, because there is definitely a Hal Roach studio style.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, the Laurel and Hardys are much, much, much better than any of the rest.
Yeah.
But there's very definitely a pacing.
Yes.
That slow burn, the one character standing by and just letting someone do something to him and then retaliating.
Yeah, especially with Laurel and Hardy, but generally with everybody at the Hal Roach Studios, the comedy comes in between the lines. In other words, it's the emphatic way that everybody does everything and the reaction shots after something is done. That's where most of the comedy happens. It's not so much the action as the reaction.
Yeah.
And that's very different from Columbia films, where it's just slam bang, do it fast. You know, sure. there's a real lineage from the Senate tradition to the Columbia shorts, because they had people like Del Lord making them, for one thing. They had a lot of old Senate people. I think Harry Edwards did a lot of Columbia shorts. So a lot of the ex-Senate people brought that fast style to the Columbia films, which are, you know, fast and violent and loud. And Hal Roach movies tend to be very quiet and easygoing. And basically it's a lot of people looking into the camera at how frustrated they are.
I can remember even as a child, because we started seeing the Our Gang films on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I guess about the time I was in first grade is when I first started noticing them. And all of us in the first grade knew how to do a double take as a result of that. I mean, we would all, if something funny happened,
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't laugh at it, but we would all do like a Marianne Jackson. We'd sort of, and everybody knew how to do it.
Uh-huh.
And it was... And that was what we thought was funny. It wasn't necessarily somebody falling in a mud puddle that we thought was funny, but it was then the close-up of the guy sitting in the mud puddle, looking at the camera going...
Yeah, look what happened to me.
Yeah.
Which intensifies the laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you'd been watching Charlie Chase movies, you'd do what they called the fig bar, which was this. You'd putting your hand to your cheek and doing a big wide mouth reaction.
And my older brother... can still do a great Finlayson with one squinted eye, which I've never been able to do, but he can do it great.
Richard Currier, who was the supervising editor, he said, well, there was never any real directive from Hal Roach specifically about it, but he said we did kind of evolve this style where the key thing was let the audience in on the gag before you let your characters in on it. So he said, you know, a guy's walking around the corner carrying a lot of packages, and then you cut to the close-up of the banana that's, you know, 20 paces in front of him. And so they know he's going to slip on the banana, and they anticipate this. And, of course, he does fall on the banana, and they laugh because they were right, basically. Mm-hmm. So the Hal Roach style is not comedy as surprise. It's comedy as fulfillment of your anticipation. Mm-hmm. And that was very much the house style. And of course you have things like the music from Leroy Shield and the same character actors and things like that. So, you know, even if you are kind of disappointed that it's a Zazu Pitts and Thelma Todd and not a Laurel and Hardy, you still have Charlie Hall and Harry Bernard and you know, the bouncy music and all those fun things that you find in every Hal Roach picture of that time.
And Thelma Todd ain't hard on the eyes either.
No, so she's pretty good. She was pretty good. Yeah. So
I'm always a little disappointed with those things because I love Zazu Pitts and I love Thelma Todd, and I always want them to be funnier than they are.
Yeah.
And they just aren't.
They were trying too hard to make them into Laurel and Hardy, I think, and have them do the physical slapstick that Laurel and Hardy did. And so, I mean, Be Big is only a sporadically funny Laurel and Hardy film. It's the one where they're pulling off that boot for 20 minutes.
Sure.
It's the one that Stan Laurel really wanted to cut down as an old man. Chuck McCann, who was a good friend of Stan's, says that Stan told him that he'd seen Be Big on television at one point. He said, I really want to cut 10 minutes out of that. You know, he had no qualms about saying that certain films were not as good as he wanted them to be. But, yeah, they try to do that too much, I think, with Zazu and Thelma. Have them do something where Zazu gets stuck in something and they have to try to get her out for the next 10 minutes, you know. And they should have really focused more on personality-driven comedy. And I think they kind of did when Patsy came along, oddly enough, because maybe there was more of a contrast between Thelma and Patsy.
Yeah.
You know?
I just never found Patsy Kelly that funny. it's always disappointing to me because at least Zazu is just – she's such an odd personality.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's kind of funny just on the face of it, whereas Patsy Kelly seemed to always be trying too hard or something.
Well, she is brash and she is loud and she's very Irish. She's good in a lot of Fox musicals. So maybe she's actually better in those than she is in the shorts with Thelma. But, yeah, she definitely has some good moments on film. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's – I mean, it's – what I'm delighted to talk to you about, well, all this stuff. We've gone very far
afield. We've really gone far.
Yeah, but
covered a wide range of things, haven't we?
That's what we do when we get together to talk.
I do know more than the Battle of the Century or the Music Box. So.
But I'm really impressed with what you've done with Laurel and Hardy over the years, because I confess that I was not unlike those publishers who turned down your manuscript when I first saw your book. And I think I must have already met you I definitely already knew you.
We had lunch together in 1980 or 81, and the book came out in April of 87.
And when I saw the book, my immediate reaction was, well, geez, don't we have enough Laurel and Hardy books?
Yeah.
Do we need this one? And then when I read it, I thought, wow,
I surprised everybody.
It's really, and I'm not just saying this to blow smoke, but it really is the best one.
Well,
and I love it, and I've always loved it, and it's a constant reference to me.
Well, I'm proud of it, but not for my own contributions. I'm proud of it basically because I did make the effort to go and get those stories from those people while they were still around to tell them.
Yeah, I don't think anybody did as much as you did in terms of talking to.
I had a lot of sleepless nights when I was a teenager because I was so hoping to do an interview with whoever it was, and I wanted to make sure they didn't die on me before I got them on tape, because these people were in their 80s and sometimes 90s when I was talking to them, you know, and I mean, history is fragile.
Well, see, now you can understand how nervous I was to get this interview with you. So
I'm only 53. I think I still have a few more years left. I hope.
So, well, Randy, thank you so much. Now,
thank you.
Before we sign off, tell the folks at home how they can contact you. Is there a website? And also plug your radio show.
Okay. Well, I do a radio show. That's another whole aspect.
I'll be back.
I have 30,000 records in that barn that's behind us there. And then I've got probably twice that amount on various hard drives. So I have lots and lots of old records going back as far as 1888. And actually extending into the 1980s, but most of what I have would be from the mid-20s through the mid-40s. That's my key period. And I do a radio show that focuses on those years called Forward Into the Past. And I've been on KSPC in the Los Angeles area for almost 30 years now. In October of 2012, it will be 30 years. Wow. And it is over the air in the Los Angeles area at 88.7 FM, and it is available worldwide on the internet at www.kspc.org. And I'm on from 2 to 5 every Sunday Pacific time. So figure that out accordingly, wherever you are in the
world. And are episodes archived so that people can listen to them later? Or
not yet on the web. I do personally have air checks for every show going back to 1990 and a lot of them from before that. So there is an archive. It's not online yet, unfortunately. But
so they need to listen between 2 and 5 on Sunday if they want to hear it.
Yes. But I'm open to requests. You can always email me at forwardintothepast@yahoo.com. And it's just all treated as if it's all one word. There's no dashes or spaces or anything. Just forwardintothepast@yahoo.com. I'm very happy to get requests for songs. And the middle hour of the three is devoted to old-time radio. So I try to cover the entire range of audible entertainment from those years. So we do all sorts of different kinds of music. There's the 20s dance bands, the swing bands, but there's also Western swing and even some out-and-out hillbilly records, or Americana, as they want to call it today. There's occasional blues records. There's lots of comedy records, personality records from people who mainly did movies but did the occasional recording. So there's a wide range of material, and we try to cover it all.
And did your title come from the Firesign Theater?
Actually, I was corresponding with one of them because he was also a friend of Marvin Hatley's. And I told him I wanted to use that as the title of my radio show, and he gave me his blessing. So,
oh, good.
I think it was Phil Proctor who said that's fine, no problem.
So, I'm proud to say he's one of my Facebook friends.
Oh, good.
Although he doesn't have any idea who I am.
I think that's the way it is with most Facebook
people. It really is. And that's the way we like it.
Yes, that's right.
Well, Randy Skredvat, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure, and
thank you.
Can't wait to come back and do several more hours
with you.
You're
welcome anytime.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the second part of my interview with Randy Skredvat. I know I enjoyed it. Really, that's all that counts, isn't it? My personal enjoyment. But I hope that you did too, and that you will join me again next week for another wonderful guest. I say vaguely because I don't quite know which one I'm going to choose to play next week. But I think I know. But I'm at CineCon this weekend, as I mentioned earlier on, and I'm doing a few interviews there, and I'm setting up some interviews with people that we'll be doing at a later date. So I have some really cool ones coming up. I want to thank everybody who had anything to do with getting the commentary track up and running. James Hutchins, who designed the wonderful thecommentarytrack.com, and also is currently designing my own personal website, or redesigning it, which is frankthompson.tv. I think if you go there now, you'll still see the old site, but it's being revamped, and James is a whiz at that stuff, so it's going to be cool. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for my great theme music, my wife Claire, McCullough Thompson, who is my announcer, and whose dulcet tones begin every episode. And I want to thank you guys for listening. I've been getting more and more response. And at this point, I'm at a kind of a grace period, and I'm appreciating it very much because I'm getting almost totally positive response from the commentary track. And people email me through the website, and they contact me through Facebook. And at CineCon, several people have come up to me and told me how much they've enjoyed it.
I do fully realize that as the thing gets more and more popular, that I'll have to deal with the negative comments, which will inevitably come, and I dread that day. But right now, it's a sweet time. I like to think of it as a honeymoon period. So thanks very much for your kind words. I hope you'll go to iTunes and give me a high rating and a good review if you feel so inclined. Those really do help spread the word. And I also hope that you'll go to the website, The Commentary Track, and buy books and videos that you see there. I have a page of each for myself, books that I've written, videos that I've had something to do with, either commentary tracks or I'm in documentaries that are on the disc or something. And I also keep a page for every single guest and have Amazon links to the books and videos that they've been connected with. And if you go to Amazon and buy any of these things, it won't cost you an extra cent if you go through my site, but it will help me because Amazon will give me a little tiny kickback. And let me stress again, it won't cost you one extra penny than if you'd just gone to Amazon in some other way. So I hope that you will consider linking to Amazon through thecommentarytrack.com because that will help me out. So we will see you next week when I'll have another wonderful guest. And is that vague enough? Because I don't know who exactly it's going to be. But it's going to be somebody really, really cool. So I will see you then. And until then, don't worry, we'll fix it in post.